Morning, Parshat Pinchas, and our parsha begins with Hashem giving a commandment to be given over to Pinchas. And in truth, we just have to remind ourselves what happened at the end of the last parsha. The end of the last parsha, after Bilam couldn't get a curse out for the Jewish people, he goes back home. He goes his way. It's unclear whether he went home or not. And the Jews settle in an area called Shittim. And they start having relationships with the girls that are there, the Moabite girls and the Midianite girls that are there. And you have to ask yourselves, what are the Midianite girls doing there? How did they get from Midian to the land of Moab? What are they doing there? And the Jews start serving the idol of Baal Peor. We discussed the Midrashim that revolve around that last week. And at the end of the parsha, one of the leaders doesn't identify who he is in last week's parsha. He walks up before Moshe and he takes a Midianite girl and he takes her into a tent. And Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron, this great Kohen, he walks up and he takes this great spear and he kills them both. And God has sent a plague among the people. The second he kills them both, the plague stops. 24,000 people are dead. And our parsha begins with Hashem telling Moshe, tell Pinchas that he did a good job. He took back my anger from the Jewish people. He took out my jealousy, so to speak, among them. And because of him, I didn't wipe them out. And therefore, tell him that I'm giving him a special treaty. I'm giving him a special peace. And he's going to have a special treaty with the Kahuna because he was zealous for his God. And now, so to speak, as an afterthought, the parasha tells us, and who was this Jew who did this terrible act? He happens to have been the head of the tribe of Shimon. His name is Zimri, the son of Salu. Funny, when the Torah listed the heads of the tribes, Zimri isn't mentioned. Where'd he go? And the Midianite woman, she's Cozbi, the daughter of Tzur. And Tzur is one of the five heads of Midian. Midian is divided into five families. Eifa, Eifer, Vachanuch, Vavido, Ve'eldo'o. Those are the five sons of Midian. And they have five kings, Evi, Rekem, Tzur, Hur, Reva. And Tzur, the middle one, is one of the kings. And his daughter, Cozbi, is the one who had this, who was in the process of having this relationship with Zimri when Pinchas walks up and kills them. So why are they mentioned as an afterthought? Why didn't the Torah tell us what's going on in last week's parsha? Now, so this week's an afterthought, the Torah brings up, oh, by the way, who were the people? These are our culprits. So our sages say that the Torah is coming to stress that firstly, Pinchas had to be very brave. He had to stand up to Shimon's tribe. He had to stand up to all the sinners who were standing around Zimri. They had heard that God declared, go judge the people and kill the sinners. And they all gathered around Zimri and they said, save us. And Zimri said, okay, I'll talk back to Moshe. And he took this girl and he said, Moshe, what's the difference between her and your wife? Your wife's from Midian, this girl's from Midian. And Pinchas had to have the guts to walk up in front of everyone and kill him. And Pinchas could have gotten killed in the process. The Gemara even says that there's a special halacha. Abuela Ramit, if one is having marital relations with an Aramis, so Kanaim Pogimbo, a person who is a Kanai, a zealous person could kill him. The Gemara says, what happens if as he's going to kill him, the person turns around and sees him coming to kill him? Is he allowed to kill him? Meaning, the Torah says you're not supposed to marry a non-Jewish woman. But having an illicit relationship, the Torah just says, his blood is free. Whoever wants to kill him could kill him. But the Torah doesn't specifically say he's forbidden to do it. The Torah says, if he does it, someone could kill him. We're supposed to infer you're not supposed to do it. But what happens if as he's doing it, he turns around and he sees the guy coming with his knife? So the Gemara says that if Zimri would have seen Pinchas, took out his knife and killed Pinchas, Zimri would have been okay. The courts couldn't have taken it out on Zimri. Zimri had sinned by going with this woman. But Pinchas risked his life and Zimri could have killed him as he was going to kill him. So Pinchas killed Zimri and now the people were saying, yeah.
Zimri has Midianite woman and Moshe has Midianite woman.
So we said that Moshe's wife became a ger. Moshe's wife became Jewish. So the whole concept of ger in that time must have been different, but we find that Paro's daughter became a ger when she joined the Jewish people, and she seems to have done it alone. And it seems that the concept of becoming a ger was different before the giving of the Torah. And Moshe's wife probably underwent the gir process when she rejoined the Jewish people later on. She did a gir process for however it was done before the Torah was given. And then she did a new gir process after the Torah was given, if she needed it. But this Midianite girl was a non-Jewish Midianite girl. You can't compare. So the Jewish people came up to Pinchas and they said, Pinchas, your great-great-grandfather was Yisro, Jethro. He was serving idols. Who are you to stand up to a great leader among the Jewish people? So who is this Zimri? One understanding says that he wasn't really the head of the tribe of Shimon. The tribe of Shimon was broken down into different families and he was the head of one of the families. But the Pasuk is stressing that he had a position of authority and it took great guts for Pinchas to stand up to him. Another understanding says that really this is a name change. Zimri wasn't his real name. His real name was Shlumiel, maybe? I don't remember. The head of the tribe of Shimon was, I think, Shlumiel ben Tzuri Shaddai, if I'm not mistaken. And he was given the nickname Zimri because Zimri was a name that represented one who did improper acts, and Ben Salu, that he also, Salu means he caused destruction for the Jewish people. So, at any rate, he was a great leader, and Pinchas stood up to him. And now the people said, Pinchas, who are you? Your great-great-grandfather was serving idols. You're standing up to kill a leader among the Jewish people. So the Torah comes and says, no, no, no. Pinchas is the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen. Don't associate Pinchas with that great-great-grandfather who did improper acts. This Pinchas has good lineage. And this opens up an interesting topic, the question of lineage. Our sages say that Moshe married Yisro's daughter. So Moshe had a great-great-grandson who served idols, like we saw in Shoftim, right? Moshe's great-grandson, the son of Gershon, his name was Yonasan. He was the one who was the chief priest for the idol of Pesel Nicha. And Elazar married Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav, who was a fine Talmud Chacham, and therefore he had a grandson who was Pinchas, who stood up to the sinners, who was a great tzaddik. So the Gemara asks, but Pinchas' great-great-grandfather was also Yisro, like we just mentioned. So the Gemara says, yeah, but he had a great-great-grandfather who was Yosef, and he had a great-great-great-grandfather who was Yisro, and it was further up in the lineage. It wasn't direct. So we see a few things. We see, A, that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't bother him to marry the daughter of a person who was a great priest. He didn't. He married her. He said, she's a great girl, I'm going to marry her. We see that our sages say that if you have a choice between a pick of a girl whose father is an idol worshiper, even though she's a great girl, and a girl whose father is not an idol worshiper, then go with the one whose father isn't an idol worshiper because you gain more. Lineage-wise, you do gain. And we see that at the end of the day, Pinchas' great-great-great-grandfather, somewhere up the line, he also had the same idol worshiper as his great-great-grandfather. But if it's further up in the lineage, it's better. Because we see he also had that same lineage, but it was further up. So that also teaches us that you can't be too nervous. People sometimes say, especially in today's world, but his great-great-great-uncle was this and that. Okay, you see that even Pinchas, who was the Gemara's example of someone who had great lineage, he was also the great-grandson of the same idol worshiper that Moshe's wife was. Yeah?
But Yitro was not an Israelite.
Yitro was not an Israelite, therefore?
Therefore...
How did they marry his daughters?
Right, I mean...
They became Gerim. We know Yisro became Gerim.
But why should he? Why is he held to the standard of idol worship? I mean, so it matters if he's.
So it is unclear whether at the time that Moshe married his daughter, he became a Ger. It seems that when he married his daughter, he was still an idol worshiper. And we brought the Medrash that Yisro said, "You want to marry my daughter? Then you have to give me your first son for idol worship. Your second son can go for Hashem service." And Moshe was convinced that he'll be able to bring Yisro to his way. But firstly, he agreed. And he took his daughter's hand. So when Moshe married his daughter, that was a girl who grew up in an idol worshipper's house who, it seems, was still serving idols.
I mean, how is it even an issue if someone who's worshipping idols is presumably not an Israelite? So
his daughter agreed to become a Jew.
Right. But I mean, you said, I'm sorry if I misunderstood, but it's better to marry someone who's not an idol worshipper, as opposed to the daughter of an idol worshipper. But in both cases, the fathers, presumably, hopefully, are not Jews.
So why? Aaron married the daughter Elisheva, the daughter of Aminadav. Aminadav was a Jew.
Right. So clearly that's a better choice, because he was a Jew and he was not an idol worshipper.
Okay, but the point is not only that that's a better choice. The point is that the effects are long range. People sometimes think, okay, Yisro did tshuva, and fine, I married his daughter and now he's a good grandfather for my kids. That's true. But when you're choosing a wife, you have to understand that the effects of who she is and what family she comes from are long term. They're not short term. And they're not things that you could tell today or in the beginning of marriage. They're things that will be tested over the course of time. So the family matters. It doesn't mean that you focus only on the family. There are a lot of people who focus on the family, and they very often don't get married for a long, long time. And then you have to wonder whether they really got the family they were so wishing for. It just means that it is something of value, and people should give it importance, and when they can, they should try and get a girl who comes from a good family. That does matter. But we said you can't go crazy over it, because Pinchas was the example of someone who came from a good family, also had a grandfather, a great-great-grandfather, who was an idol worshipper. The same idol worshipper, the same Yisro. Now, when Aaron was made Kohen, so God said, anoint Aaron, anoint his son Elazar and Isamar, and Nadav and Avihu, and the children they'll have from now on will be Kohanim. So, it is unclear whether the children that were born prior to the anointment, Elazar and Isamar's children that were born before they were anointed, did they become Kohanim? So Rashi goes with the opinion that they did not become Kohanim, and therefore until this point, Pinchas was a non-Kohen. Even though he was the son of Elazar and the grandson of Aaron, when the anointment process took place, it was for Aaron, his children, and the children they would have from that point and on. And Pinchas was already in the world. There is an opinion that says that no, it worked on the whole family and Pinchas was a Kohen. Either way, we have a halacha that says that if a Kohen murders someone, that Kohen is disqualified from doing much of the services. And nowadays it's relevant that Kohen can't duchen, he can't go up for the blessing of the Kohanim. This is relevant when a Kohen, God forbid, is in a traffic accident and by mistake he kills someone, so he has a problem, he can't go up to duchen. Now Pinchas here did that exact thing. He killed someone. So you'd think that would bring him down as far as Kohanim go. Kohen that killed a Jew can't go up in Duchen. And here God says, no, it's the other way around. Pinchas either until now was not a Kohen and now he's being moved up a notch and he's going to be a Kohen. Or Pinchas was a Kohen and he didn't lose his kahuna by doing this. Depending on which understanding you go with. What did he have? Kohanic rights until this point or not. Now, Pinchas not only gained to be a Kohen, but almost all the Kohanim Gedolim, almost all the high priests, came from Pinchas. Pinchas himself was Kohen Gadol towards the end of the period of the judges. Then Pinchas sinned in the story of Yiftach, when Yiftach made a vow that he'd offer the first thing that approaches him, and then he wanted to offer his daughter, so Yiftach said, I'm not going to go to Pinchas, I'm the great general. Pinchas said, he's Namaritz, I'm not going to him. Now Pinchas lived right near Yiftach. Pinchas lived in the section of land called Gilad, and Yiftach lived in the section of land called Gilad. It wasn't a great distance from one to the other, and neither one was willing to forgo his honor, and in the end Yiftach killed his daughter, mistakenly, he was an Amoritz. And Pinchas' punishment was that he lost his prophecy for a long period, and he lost his rights to Kuna Gadola. And that's why we find in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel that Eli is Kohen Gadol, and Eli is from the family of Itamar. You remember, Pinchas is the son of Elazar. Aaron had two sons that remained. One was Elazar and one was Itamar. And the Kuna Gadola went over to Itamar's family right after the story of Yiftach. And we have Eli, and then Eli's son Sin, as we're going to see next week. So when King David becomes king, the Kuna Gadola goes back to Pinchas' family. And from then on, till the end of the first temple, and even the beginning of the second temple, Pinchas' offsprings are the ones who are Kohanim Gadolim. So Pinchas not only becomes a Kohen in our Parsha, he's ultimately going to be the Kohen Gadol, and he's going to be the Kohen Gadol whose offsprings are Kohanim Gadolim. God gives him his treaty of peace. What does it mean, his treaty of peace? So one understanding says that if a person is zealous for the sake of Hashem, so then even though he might have to kill for it, and then God says, I'll give him peace. That's the best promise you could give him. And the other understanding says that the treaty of peace is that he never died. We have a tradition that Pinchas never passed away. Pinchas became Elio, and Elio never died. Elio went into Gan Eden alive. Pinchas and Elio are the same person, and Elio still appeared to great sages like we have in the Gemara. And they say even the Ravid, the one who comments on the Rambam, Elio appeared to him. The Gemara records that one time one of the Amoraim saw Elio in a grave, in a graveyard. So the Amora said to him, 1 second, you're a Kohen, how could you be there? So Elio said, I'm standing among non-Jewish graves, and non-Jewish graves aren't Netame, so I'm okay. The Gemara says that when they had a question, what exactly happened in Pilegesh Begiva, so one of the Amoraim met up with Elio, and he asked him, what's God doing now? And he said, he's learning the story of Pilegesh Begiva, the story in the end of Shoftim. So he said, oh yeah, really, we're stuck on the end of this Medrash, what's God saying? How did it work there? So he said, God's saying that my son, Yonason, he says, this is what happened, and my son, Levi, he's saying, this is what happened. She said, what do you mean? God's uncertain, he's contingent on what we say. She says, no, God's saying both of them happened, and he's quoting the opinions that are mentioned down here. So we find time and again that Elio appeared to our sages, and Pinchas was given the treaty of peace, and according to one understanding, he was Elio. Does that mean literally he was Elio? So from the Gemara, it seems it does. And Ibn Ezra and others who like to explain pshat say that can't be, because God tells Pinchas, I'll give the treaty, the treaty will be for him, ulizaro, and for his offsprings, acharav, after him. What does it mean after him? If he never died, there's no time that's after him. So that's why the Ibn Ezra and others want to say, no, that when Chazal say that Pinchas is Elio, it just means that the strength of Pinchas and that spark, that flame that Pinchas represents in Judaism reappeared in Elio. We find the Gemara says that Lavan was Bilam, was Nebuchadnezzar, was... The Gemara says that the Lavan was the same person throughout many, many generations. Again, they say, does it mean he lived such a long life? Or does it mean that the same spark of evil that was shining in Lavan showed up again in Bilam and Nebuchadnezzar, etc.? So, Minchas is Elio, however you want to understand that. And, yeah.
Aren't we all sort of coming after Eliyahu, though? Like, in a way, don't we all kind of belong to Eliyahu, in a way? I mean, in the sense.
What do you mean?
Because we're waiting for him, and, I don't know, he's a special kind of figure. I mean, he's a special kind of figure for Nabi.
So maybe we'll stop and talk about Elio a little bit. Who is Elio? So Elio is the prophet that appears on the scene during the time of kings. We find him primarily in the time of Ahav, the king of Israel. And during the time of Ahav, he does great miracles. He gets the whole Jewish people to recognize that God is running the world and not the idols of the Baal. And after he does that, the queen, Izebel, who's non-Jewish, she comes from Tzidon, from the north, from a different nation, she sends word to Elio, you just killed out my prophets, tomorrow I'm going to kill you. And Elio runs and he wants to die. And God sends an angel who gives him, he tells him, get up, Elio, eat and drink, you got a long way to go. And Elio goes out into the desert of Sinai, and he goes into a cave, the same cave in which Moshe Rabbeinu was. And Elio is sustained for 40 days and 40 nights from eating and drinking what the Malach gave him to eat and drink that day. Sound like Moshe Rabbeinu? He ends up in the same cave, and God says, come out of the cave. And what are you? And when he comes out of the cave, God asks him, what you doing here, Elio? And Elio says, Kano kinesi l'Hashem, I was zealous for Hashem. Notice the same term as Pinchas, kino. I was zealous for Hashem, tzvokos, for the Jewish people have left your treaty. They've stopped performing your mitzvos. I'm the only one left, and they wanted to kill me, so I ran over here. They want to kill me. So God says, listen up. And God makes a great vision of God's appearance. There's great thunder, and there's great noise, and a whole procession of awesome things, and each time God says, I'm not yet there. And finally, at the end, after all those awesome things, there's a slight, slight, soft, soft sound. And God says, you hear that quiet, that soft quiet, or that soft sound? That's where God is. And then God tells him, Elio, what you doing here? And Elio goes over the same speech a second time. He says, Kano kinesi, I was zealous twice for Hashem, the Jewish people. They left your treaty. They're not performing your mitzvos. I'm the only one left, and even me they want to kill, so I ran over here. So God gave him a prophecy, and God asked him the same question. And Elio answered the same answer. So God said, Elio, your job's over. Go, appoint a new king for the Jews, appoint a new prophet, and you're coming up to heavens. Your job isn't to be there to say the Jewish people aren't doing well. That's not what a prophet's job is. You have to tell me what they're doing good, not what they're doing bad. And therefore we have tradition that God said to Elio, from now on, you're going to have to stick around and go to every bris, and you're going to testify every time, they're keeping my bris. You said, they're not keeping my bris, you're going to go to every bris and show they do. Every Pesach, we have a treaty over Pesach, every Pesach you go and you testify that they're keeping Pesach. And so we have a tradition that Elio shows up to every Seder. And we have tradition that Elio shows up to every bris. And the end of the prophets, the last prophet we have is in Treyasar, Malachi. And what's the last verse in Malachi? Malachi says, Hine anochi sholech lachem. God says, behold, I will send you. Et Eliyahu anavi, Eliyahu the prophet, lifnei bo yom Hashem agadol vanora, before the great day of Hashem comes. Ve'eshiv levavot al banim. And he will return the hearts of the fathers to their children. Ve'lev banim al avotam. And the hearts of the sons to their fathers. So the end of the prophecy is, the last prophet ends his last prophecy saying that Eliyahu is going to come. That's what was just mentioned. What's the importance of Elio's coming? Elio is coming before the great day, and he's coming to make peace between the sons and their fathers. So what does that mean, between the sons and their fathers? So one understanding says that Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, they're very upset at us. Look at how we're behaving. So they're upset. So Elio's going to come back and make peace between us and our forefathers and the patriarchs. Another understanding says that Elio is going to come, and he's going to start answering questions. And then he's going to know what the great sages always knew, what everyone's true lineage is. So he's going to start looking around and smelling out, hey, that person is Jewish, that person isn't Jewish. That person is Jewish, that person isn't Jewish. And he's going to look around, he's going to know exactly what's going on. That person's walking around with a long beard and a jacket, and I know that he's a mamzer, he's a bastard, he's not even allowed to marry the Jewish families. That person, everyone's treating like a mamzer, he's a perfectly good Jew. Elio is going to know all the secrets. So the Gemara says, Elio is going to come back, and every question we're going to have in Halacha, he's going to be able to answer, but he'll know beyond what we're asking. So everyone's going to get scared. Hey, maybe he'll give away my secret. So the Gemara says, no, that's not Elio's job. Elio's job is Veshiv Levavot. He brings people close. He won't push anyone away. Elio will only bring people close. At any rate, Elio is supposed to come and fix things a little bit before the great day of Hashem's arrival. So Pinchas, who was so zealous in last week's parasha, and is given this great treaty in our parasha, ultimately that spirit is supposed to be with us till the end of time, till the time when he'll reappear, and make peace again. Again, what's his job at the end of time? To make peace. What's his job every day nowadays? He goes to every bris and goes back and he reports in heavens and he says, God, they're doing it. Another bris mila, another bris mila, another bris mila. What's he doing? He's making peace. That's Pinchas' job today. And that's the treaty he was given in our parsha also. Briti Shalom, the treaty of peace. Yeah.
So that's why Hashem gave him a cool wheel so he can get around everywhere.
Yeah, he's got cool wheels. The Gemara says that there was an Amora who was called by a... was called over by a Roman, a very important Roman woman, and she called him into her chambers, and she said, I want you. Now Amora says, wait, I'm not ready. Let me put on my tie, let me get ready, let me get good looking. And he walked over to the roof, and he jumped off. He was a blacksmith or something. I don't remember what his job was. He fixed women's shoes. I don't remember. He did something that had to do with women. So he jumped out the window. And Elio caught him. And that's the swift wheels you're talking about. So Elio said to him, you know how far away I was? You make me work so hard, you know how much I had to run for you? So he said to Elio, he said, is it my fault? Look at how poor I am. I can't make any money. I have to do this low job. I end up stuck with women. What's it my fault? So Elio said, you're right. And Elio gave him this big gold piece and he was rich for the rest of his life. That's the Gemara says. So sometimes faith to have a good answer. But yeah, Elio has swift wheels. That's what the Gemara says. Elio, he gets around quickly. He's got to make it to all the bris. So Pinchas gets the Treaty of Peace after standing up. And it took great courage. Pinchas didn't know he would make it. God says, Sarur et Midianim. I want you to hate and to afflict, put a siege on the Midianites. Now the Midianites don't seem to be a local tribe. They seem to be out in the east. I don't know how close they were to where they were, but it doesn't seem like they were so close by. And we have a commandment to go attack them because of what they've done to us. They've caused us to sin. And we derive from here, Gadol amachti et chavero yoter me'orgo. One who causes his friend to sin is worse than one who tries to kill him. If you kill a person, you kill them in this world. You try to make a person sin, then that's a sin in this world and the world to come. And the sin of marrying a non-Jewish woman is one of the worst sins there are, because that ultimately brings a person away from Judaism altogether. And the Gemara says that Habuela Ramit, if a person has relations with a non-Jewish woman, then that causes something to happen within him spiritually, and that undoes the bris that a person has. Meaning when a child is 8 days old, he gets a bris milah. We circumcise him. And the Gemara says that the second he's circumcised, he has a certain aura, his neshama. And when in heavens, he gets judged at the end of his days, so if he deserves to go to Gehenim, to hell, so Avram Avinu is sitting at the gates. And everyone that wants to come in, Avram checks him. And if he's circumcised, Avram says, you don't belong in here, get out of here. And he sends him away. But if he had relations with a non-Jewish woman, so then the Gemara says Avram can't recognize him. Then he loses some of that aura. And then Avram misses him, and he could enter. So this is... The Gemara enumerates this as one of the worst sins, if not the worst sin there is, even though the Torah doesn't specifically say. The Torah says you're not allowed to marry them. The prohibition of having relations without a permanent relationship is not expressed specifically in the Torah. But the Torah alludes many times to it, and the Torah does say that he can be killed by a kanai. He doesn't need a court to judge him. He could be killed in the act. And at the end of the day, that's usually what will bring a person away from maintaining every mitzvah.
The Melech, or one of the kings, the law was that they were allowed to go with
non-Jews. There's an Eshet Yifato. That's a different term. We'll get to that mitzvah in about 4 weeks. Whoever's here for Ben Osmanim, I think that's a parsha. Joseph Ben Osmanim. We'll discuss Eshet Yifato. I don't know if Eshet Yifatar, how that works. If that causes him, if David went with an Eshet Yifatar, if Avram recognized him in heaven. As funny as that sounds, you would assume that, yeah, that Avram recognized him, but I don't have a source for that. It's like a logical assumption, but I don't know. So we have a command to place siege to attack the Midianites, because of what they've done to us. And this commandment isn't fulfilled in this parsha. Next week we'll discuss how they did it. In our parsha, it doesn't enumerate what happened. We'll see next week that Bilaam came to the scene, and there's a medrash that he had the Midianites flying on carpets, and they went to attack. There's a whole medrash how it worked, because the parsha attests to the fact that Bilaam was killed when the Midianites were killed, and the question is, what was Bilaam doing there? So one understanding says he came to get his money. He said, I gave you this advice, and you see 24,000 people died in the plague after you put your girls available to the Jews, so pay up. Now, the Midianites did something exceptional. They took their top girl, the daughter of the great King Tzur, and they said, go, make Moshe sin. Go seduce him. It's exceptional to take the king's daughter for this kind of job. I guess she was very good looking. Our parasha continues with a commandment to count the nation. Now, why is it important to count the nation? First of all, why is it ever important to count the nation? In general, we have a commandment not to count the Jewish people. It's forbidden biblically to count the Jewish people. Why? Who knows why? We could understand certain things. We might be able to understand certain aspects of why. But the real reason why, only God knows. What we know is that God promised that the Jewish people will be so great in numbers that they'll never be able to be counted. They'll never be able to be assessed. And when you count, you're limiting them to an amount. That's one understanding we could have. And yet God says, count them. So why does God say to count them in our parasha? So one understanding says that 24,000 people died. When you love something, then when something happens to it, you automatically check how it's doing.
They already told us 24,000 people died.
Oh, the Torah says that, but God says, so to speak, this is my sheep. A wolf came into my sheep and devoured a lot of sheep. I want to see how many are left.
No, but we knew 24,000 died before Hashem.
We know. The Torah writes it. God didn't need Moshe to count in order to know
right.
the numbers. You also have to ask yourself if a round number of 24,000 is really 24,000 exactly. And this is a point everyone should remember. If, God forbid, there's a terrorist attack, so you guys should call home and let your loved ones know you're okay, because the nature of a person is when you love someone and something bad happens, you want to know how that person's doing. That's what God's saying here. There was a plague. Show me how my beloved are doing, how the Jewish people are doing. Another understanding says that Moshe Rabbeinu just led them 40 years, and we're at the end of the 40 years now. This is it. We're at our last encampment before we're going to cross over into the land of Israel.
Yippee.
And in our parsha, Yeshua is going to be given the reins to an extent. He's going to be given the leadership. So God's saying, hey, Moshe, you got them a certain number. Let's see where it's holding. You're about to give them back. Give me back, let's see where the Jewish people are holding.
An inventory.
Inventory, right, okay.
this is the third time you've been counted. This is the third time? Once.
And they entered first time?
At the very first at Har Sinai. We were counted by the half shekel.
40 years earlier.
And then another time, shortly thereafter. But obviously Hashem knows how many people there are. He's a great mathematician, even better than this guy here. So he knows. But also there's one story that says he's like a king that loves his gold, that he loves his people so much that he likes to count them more than one of them.
That's another understanding, right? There are more understandings. Here it was necessary to make a census because the next stage is going to be dividing up the land, and the division, to some extent, is going to be contingent on the numbers of each tribe. So God says, let's get a count. So the parasha continues by giving us the count of each family. And we skip forward to the end of the count, and we're holding by Shlishi. Perek Chafav, 26th chapter, Pasuk Nun Beis, 52. And God says, this is how you divide the land. You give more to the larger tribes, less to the smaller tribes, which is unclear what that means, because the land was divided by lot. And it's interesting that God says, divide it by lot. So we have a tradition that when they drew the lots, right, they took out a lot, and the Kohen would say, before he looked at the lot, he'd say, if what comes into my hand is this tribe, this is the portion they're going to get. And then they'd look at the lot, and that's what happened. They had drawn that tribe, and that was the portion. And God said, I reveal myself through the lots. When we enter the land of Israel, so we conquer the city of Jericho, and we take a vow that all the loot from the city of Jericho will be given to God. We won't benefit from it. And there's one person by the name of Achan who steals from the loot. And then when we go to fight the city of Ai, which is a relatively small city, we don't even send all the troops out, we lose the war. A lot of people die. 19 people and Asael. 19 people and Asael.
The one guy.
I think so. So, no, that doesn't make sense. I forgot. We didn't lose that many, but we lost the war. So, Yoshua, who's running the show then, turns to Hashem and says, what are we going to do? And he fasts and he cries, and God says, the Jewish people have sinned. You're not going to last this way. You can't succeed. What did they sin? God says, someone stole from the loot last time. And it turns out that this man, Achan means a snake. His name was Achan, like a snake. This man, Achan, had stolen from the loot in the time of Moshe also, when we had said that we would turn all the loot over to Hashem. This isn't the first time. So Achan stole from the loot, and God says, draw lots. Moshe asks God, tell me who stole. And God says, draw lots. What do you think, I'm a snitch, I'm a tattletale? I'm going to tell you who did it. Draw lots, and the lots will reveal it. So they draw lots, and they first do it. Single out which tribe and then which family, and then they draw lots, and out comes Achan. So Achan turns to Yoshua and he says, fine, if you say the lot proved something, I agree, no problem. Let's put your name on a piece of paper. Let's put the Kohen Gadol, Elazar's name, on a piece of paper. Let's put them in a pot. Now draw one of them. One of you stole, and we'll see what comes out, who stole from the loot. The fact that you drew lots, someone had to come out, so I came out. I'll prove it to you. I'll put your name, I'll put Elazar's name in, I'll draw, and someone's going to come out, right? So what does that prove? Nothing, right? So what does it prove that my name came out in the lot? At which point, Yeshua bends down to Achan, and he says, B'ni sim kavod, please give honor to the God of Israel. God told the Jewish people to divide the land of Israel based upon the lots in our parsha. And if you start speaking this way about the lots, you're going to end up causing big fights. Because then every tribe that doesn't like its portion is going to say, well, what's the lot worth? So don't cause such a destruction among the Jewish people. And Achan did tshuva. And Achan said, I stole it. And he told them where it was, under his tent. And they went quickly and they found the stuff that he stole. And he was put to death. But he merits the world to come because he did tshuva. But Achan, in that story, we saw that these lots really were put to test. It's not so simple to have your lot in life be decided by drawing lots. But that's what God said. So the Jewish people accepted it. The daughters of Tzlafchad come forth. Tzlafchad is a man who... we don't know much about him. We know he died. Either he was the one who desecrated the Shabbos or something else. We don't know exactly how he died. But we know he died, maybe a natural death. And he had no sons. And he was the firstborn in his father Hefer's family. So his daughters were very smart girls. They were such smart girls and loyal girls that for 40 years they couldn't find the right match, the right shidduch. They were old maids. They didn't get married. And they were over 40, all five of them. But they were fine Tamidei Chachamim. And when the Beis Medrash started learning this commandment that God gave, divide the land, so they walked forth and they said, look, our father died without kids, and we know we're supposed to inherit him, but we claim that we have to get an extra portion. We have to get his portion in his father's lot and his double portion in his father's lot. So we're supposed to get three portions. His portion that he deserved in the land of Israel, and the double portion he deserved in his father's land. We deserve all three. Now, if you consider us like his son, that you'll give us three portions, fine. And if you don't consider us like a son, then let our mother remarry, because a person who dies without children to inherit him, so then the wife has to remarry to one of the siblings, let her do Yibam. So which way is it going to go? So they came with this, not ultimatum, but this very sharp question to Moshe. And Moshe said, gee, I don't know. Now they had a very good claim. How come Moshe didn't know? What they said was very logical. And God backed them up. God said, hey, they're right. So our sages say that when Moshe established the high courts, the whole court system among the Jewish people, he told them, you have a question, you move it up to a higher court. You have a question, move it up a notch. And when it's too tough for all of you, then you could come to me and I'll answer it. And the greater a person is, the greater God looks at every single word he says and takes him to the hair with. And Moshe said that, so God said, okay, I'll show you something that even these girls, they'll have good logic, and you'll be in doubt. You'll say, gee, I don't know. And that's this. God paid him back for that over here. So Moshe had to say, I don't know. And he turned to God, and God said, yeah, they're right. That's how you divide it. If a person has no sons, so his daughters get his portion. Now, think historically where the world was holding. If any of you ever read the codes of Hammurabi, which people like to quote in reference to the Torah, tell us, how do the codes of Hammurabi deal with women? I was amazed. I read it once I started reading it, and I was so amazed. I had such derech for the Torah after reading it. It was so illogical and so distant from the Torah. People compare it. The
only thing I remember is that the story about calling your wife your sister was an Iraqi custom.
Could be. We find in Shir HaShirim that a person can call the beloved person my sister. I'm just saying, the laws in general, you see in those times, the laws were vicious and women had almost no rights. And here the Torah is saying that a daughter can inherit, if there are no brothers, she inherits equally. The problem is that her husband's going to inherit her or her children, and then if she marries into another tribe, then that whole section of land switches to another tribe. So you could have tribes being cut up, where most of the land from this area belongs to tribe X, and parts of the land, these little sections, are going to be belonging to other tribes. God tells Moshe to come up to a mountain, which is the mountain where he's ultimately going to die, and he tells him, look over into the land of Israel before you die. You're going to die like your brother Aaron died. And here we see a very important concept. Moshe is going to live for many months from now. All of Sefer Dvarim is still going to take place. And yet God tells him now he's going to die like Aaron died. Why is that important? When Moshe was standing and watching his brother Aaron die, he saw Aaron walk into a room and there was a lamp there and a bed. And Aaron lied down on the bed and he took off his clothes. And he folded his arms on his chest, and he closed his eyes, and he breathed his last breath, and God gave him a kiss, and he died. And Moshe saw that beautiful death, and he said, I want that too. And God over here is telling him, you'll get that. It might take a few months, because Moshe is going to live for a while now, but you're going to get that. And here we see one thing, and we'll see a few things from it. We see the concept of telling someone that something he wants he's going to get. Men have a tendency to like giving surprises. We like surprising our parents. We like surprising our wives. We like surprising our kids. And the element of surprise has a certain value. But there's an element where anticipation outweighs the element of surprise. If you tell your parents, Mom, Dad, in 2 months I'm coming to visit you, and this is something my mother-in-law taught me. I was once going to surprise my parents, and she told me, you'd be doing them a much better favor if you tell them 2 months in advance you're coming. Because for the next 2 months, they're going to spend those 2 months in anticipation that their son is coming. And they'll enjoy those 2 months so much more than that 1 second of surprise when they open the door and they see you. And she's right. And I think that's one of the things we see here. God tells Moshe, he tells him, you're going to get it. You're going to get that death which you wanted. You're going to be able to die that peaceful, sweet death that you saw your brother pass away. It's a medrash that's what God was telling him here. God told him literally that you will die just as your brother Aaron died. What did God mean by that? So the literal understanding is, just like he didn't get away with it, you're not going to get away with it. He had to die, you're going to die. But our sages say that God was saying something deeper. When God said, just like Aaron died, he was telling Moshe, you're going to merit to get that same peaceful death that you saw Aaron get and wished to get. This is in the positive. And in the negative, we have a halacha that goes also strengthening this point. The Maseches Derech Eretz quotes that in their time, the way they used to punish kids is they tug them by the ear. I don't know, in Europe, do they still do this? Pull kids by the ears? Yeah? Okay. I've always wondered if you can't damage the kid's ear that way. I mean, chances are you could. But that's how they used to punish kids. So the
small ears, do I?
Says in Avos, in Maseches Derech Eretz, that a kid once did something wrong. He ran away from school or something. And his father heard about it, and he got upset. So he pointed to the ear. Told the kid, boy, are you going to get it? And he let the kid go. And the kid was so scared, he jumped into a pit and committed suicide. And from there we derive a halacha that a parent or a rebbe may not threaten with a punishment. A parent or a rebbe, if they're going to punish, they have to give the punishment right away. They can't tell a kid, boy, are you going to get it? Because in the child or in the other person's mind, the anticipation of what's going to happen is so bad that it's worse than what actually happens afterwards. And most people know that the fear before the dentist is usually much worse than the time you're sitting in that chair. That's why I keep knives over here for atafas damris. Because if guys tell me they need to do it, I don't want them to spend time thinking about it. I want to say, okay, come, we'll do it now. Because that's this halacha, that the anticipation, the fear, when you don't know what it's going to be like, is much worse than what actually happens, and we're scared, literally, that the child will commit suicide. And that's halacha also. Just like we said, that positive anticipation is a good thing, it's a gift you give someone. So we see also negative anticipation is forbidden. It's something that's, you're paining the person, and you can't fathom how much you're paining him, you can't know. Moshe hears that he's going to die. And Moshe hears that God just said that kids inherit their father, and if there's no son, then the daughters do. So Moshe says, if everyone's going to be doing all this inheriting, God, we need a new leader for the Jewish people. Now this can be understood on a few fronts. On one front, Moshe's hoping his kids are going to get the role. We have a halacha that says that if a person has a position of leadership in the Jewish people, or a position of representing the people, if he's a chazan, he's the Baal Tokea, he's the Baal Kore in a shul, and he's passing away or he's losing the job, then his children get first dibs. They have first rights if they're fit for the job. If a rabbi is too old, he needs a new rabbi, so the first person that gets the job is his son. If a king... If he's not qualified, so obviously he can't be a rabbi. But if he is qualified, then he comes first before someone else. There's even a discussion if his son is a good chazan, but they want to hire a better chazan. So the halacha says that his son has a very strong weight. There's a discussion. Can they say, yeah, but we want someone with a better voice? If he says, yeah, but I have as good a voice as my father, then there are opinions that say that you can't push him off. Because he's saying, I'm not less than my father. If I'm not less than my father, then I fill his shoes. And Moshe over here is asking, who's going to lead the people after me?
But who is Moshe's son anyway?
Moshe had a son named Gershom. Right?
Right.
We don't hear much about them, right? We have a tradition that great rabbis and great leaders will have children who are not great rabbis and not great leaders. The Gemara says, why is it that the great rabbis' children are not great rabbis? So the Gemara says, so people won't think that Torah is inherited. Whoever wants can get it. God made a special segula in the world, if you're a big rabbi, your children won't be. It's rare to find someone who's a big rabbi and his children aren't. And the children are going to have a much harder time getting there than someone else. On the one hand, they grow up with a home that's so on such a high level, and that's why we value Bat Talmid Chacham. The daughter of a Talmud Chacham, we say, is something of great value. If you can marry a daughter of a Talmud Chacham, then she grew up, certain things are in her blood. I have a friend whose father is a big rabbi. It's amazing. I talked to him about many things, and it's in his blood. Like, he doesn't have to learn it. He knows it. He grew up with it. Things I have to break my head. He grew up with it. It's a given. He'd ask his father a question, and he'd get an answer on the highest level. So there, it's definitely an asset, and it helps, but there's a special segula that if a person is a big Talmud Chacham, his children won't be.
I know, I was saying that. Poor Rav Cook.
So in order for Rav Cook's son to be a big Talmud Chacham, obviously he had to work much harder. But he had the cards stacked against him. Rabbi Feinstein also had a son who was a big Tam Chacham. But the cards were stacked against him. And that's a special school. God says, I don't want to discourage people. People shouldn't think you need to be the son of a big rabbi to be a big rabbi. So God says, I'm not gonna help him out. And the Gemara says, Izaru b'vnei aniyim, be careful with the sons of poor people, because from them are going to grow the leaders of the next generation. It's not from the sons of the great rabbis. You want to know where the next leaders are going to be? The Gemara says it's the sons of the poor people.
What do you break your head on?
What do you mean break your head on?
You said you break
a lot of things. You make it sound like it's one thing. What don't I break my head on? Not many things. Learning this parsha. So Moshe asks Hashem, who's going to lead the people? And here we see one of the beautiful traits of the leaders, that he's being told he's going to die. And God doesn't tell him when he's going to die. We have a tradition that no man knows the day he's going to die. King David was very interested in knowing when he was going to die. And he kept asking God, when am I going to die? And God said, I created the world in a fashion that I don't tell anyone. And finally, King David said, okay, tell me which day of the week. So God said on Shabbos. So King David said, okay, could it be Sunday? So God said, no, Sunday your son's supposed to take the throne. And in the heavens we decree when exactly a kingdom is supposed to end and the next kingdom is supposed to begin. And one kingdom cannot overlap the other, even a hair's width. So King David said, fine, can it be Friday? So God says, no, it's supposed to be till Shabbos. Shabbos it's going to be. So King David died on Shabbos. David HaMelech died on Shabbos. The Gemara says that his body was out in the heat and they didn't know what to do with it. How could they move it? It's Muktzeh. And Shlomo was a new king. He's 12 years old and he doesn't know what to do. So he sent word to the Sanhedrin. He said, what do I do with the body? I have two questions, he said. My father died and his body's out in the sun, and my father's dogs are hungry. Am I allowed to feed them? And here we see that King David had dogs. People very often say, are you allowed to own dogs? We see he had dogs.
King Shlomo was appointed King David.
Excellent question. I was waiting. No one asked that.
I knew the question.
Excellent question. King Shlomo was appointed king in King David's life. Shlomo was king in David HaMelech's life. So what is Hashem telling David? It's time for King Shlomo to be king, and then you can't take any room from his kingdom. That's an excellent question. It seems that there's the strength of a king when two kings are together, and there's the strength of a king when he alone is king. And what Hashem was telling David was that at that point, Shlomo is supposed to reign alone in the world. And that element of kingdom you cannot take from him. Up until that point, you're supposed to be together. You were supposed to be king alone until the point you anoint, when you anoint Shlomo. And then you're supposed to spend X amount of time as kings together. And at that point, on that Shabbos, he's supposed to become king alone. That's what Rabbi Yort, the head of the Kollel in Teferes Yerushalayim, told me when I asked him this question. That's how he explained it to me. I don't know. I didn't see inside anyone that deals with the question. Maybe it's written in Rashi and Tosas there, and I don't remember, but that's how he answered it. So now Moshe is saying, who's going to take over? And Moshe is concerned with who's going to lead the Jewish people. God tells him he's going to die. He doesn't know exactly which day it's going to be yet. On that day, God tells him, today you're going to die. Until that day, he doesn't know. And what's his concern? His concern is, who's going to lead? I don't want to leave the Jewish people alone. And this is one of those questions that Moshe asked Hashem. And he said, Hashem, I'm not leaving till I get an answer. Moshe Rabbeinu said, this is so important to me, I beg you, please give me an answer now. And Moshe asked for a leader who would be understanding to the Jewish people, a leader who could lead them and can have understanding and understand each person, because each person is different and each person needs different treatment. And Hashem tells him, there was one person who always was by your side learning, and that's Yeshua, and I want you to give him smicha. He's going to be the next leader. God says, lean one hand on him. Our sages say, why did Yeshua merit to be the next leader? Because every day he would arrange the benches. Everyone would leave, everyone has to go home, everyone's tired, everyone wants to go to lunch break. everyone comes in, they want to learn, he would always be the one to arrange the benches. It wasn't only that he was learning every minute and learning by Moshe. For some reason, this aspect of arranging the benches had importance. Rabbi Pessin always used to say that in the great yeshivas in Europe, they would auction off the right to be the one to clean the Beis Medrash and the right to be the one to clean up, to set up the benches. They would auction it off. You had to be worthy to do it. I once asked him, how come I see Rabbi Feinstein in the summer when there's no one there to fill the soda machines? He'd stand there and fill the soda machines. He'd put the cans into the soda machine. So I said, the guy's the top posik in the country, and how come he's standing there filling the soda machine? So he said...
He doesn't drink soda.
I don't remember seeing him drink soda. Maybe. He told me this. He said that filling a soda machine is an act that you're serving the Beis Medrash. And when a person is on a higher level, then he values what it means to serve a Beis Medrash. Today we think simply, okay, he's the one that cleans the Beis Medrash. No, it's worth something to be the one to clean the Beis Medrash. Yeshua, by the merit of the fact that he was the one that set up the benches, he merited to be the next leader. He cared to set up the Beis Medrash, not just to learn in it. So that's how he explained it to me then. So Moshe is told, lean one hand on him and appoint him as the next leader. Establish him before the high priest and let him ask the Urim Betumim. We have a halacha that only the leader of the Jewish people can ask the Kohen Gadol a question that the Kohen Gadol answers from the Urim Betumim. The leader stands and the Kohen Gadol stands with his back to him facing the Shechina, and he asks the question, and then the Kohen Gadol gets the response, and he looks at the Urim Betumim and he tells the leader the response, and God says, do this with Yoshua. Set him up in front of everyone, have him ask the Kohen Gadol, and have him get an answer, and let everyone see that he's the leader. What's the idea? The idea is that when Moshe passes away, we don't want Yoshua to take the throne then. And then everyone will claim, oh, now you're saying you're supposed to be the next leader. Who said? Why didn't Moshe ever tell us? So God says, avoid conflict. Make it abundantly clear that he's supposed to be the next leader. And here we see something very important. You'd think that you're supposed to be done the kavschos. I remember once I used to have jelly bean machines. I used to make money on jelly bean machines. So I had a store that we were talking with, and we almost closed the deal to put in a jelly bean machine there. And we had to just close the deal. So I come to the store, and the owner of the store is carrying boxes. So I come to help him with the boxes. And he doesn't know who I am. We've only spoken by phone. So I help him with the boxes, and when we finish, I tell him who I am. So he says, oh, now I know why you helped me with the boxes. So I tell him, what do you mean? You don't want to be done me lekav zchus, it's the month of Elul. I'm a good Jew, I like helping people, that's why I helped you with the boxes. So he said, there's to be done lekav zchus, and then there's to be realistic. So our parasha teaches us that point. God says, God could have said, let's be done lekav zchus. The Jewish people, they're going to sin. They're going to cause a fight. Yoshua says he's supposed to be the next leader. I'll back him up. God doesn't say that. God says we have to be realistic. We don't want them to fight. So now, in front of the Jewish people, take Yoshua and show them all that he's supposed to be the next leader. Don't wait till you pass away and then Yoshua will come up and then people will have room to have a claim. And in general, we have a rule in Halacha that we say, based on the verse in Mishlei, Hasel mimecha ikshut peh, remove from yourself a slanderous mouth, ulezut sfataim achek mimecha, and distant from yourself people's ability to say bad things about you. It says, umtzachen, a person should find favor, v'sechel tov, and good brain, a person should seem smart and good in the eyes of Elohim ve'adam, the eyes of God and men. It's not enough that a person says, I know what I'm doing is good. Person should also be concerned that other people should think it's good. Doesn't mean that you look around every second and say, gee, how are people looking at me? But on the other hand, the person should try to do things in a fashion that people will look at it positively. I once wanted to write a book about how all the philosophies show up in Tanakh and in our sages. And it's just an interesting point. Everyone knows the story of the chicken, the hen that was baking the bread, and she asked everyone to come help her to plant the wheat, and all the other animals on the farm were busy. You guys don't know that story? It's a famous children's story in the United States. The hen went to everyone else and said, help me plant the wheat. And they all said, we're busy. Then went to everyone else and said, help me take out the weeds. And they all said, we're busy. Now, in the children's story, there are details. The pig said, I'm busy with my mud, etc. I assume you guys don't need that. The hen said, come help me cut the wheat. And they all said, we're busy. Said, come help me thresh the wheat. They all said, we're busy. Said, come help me sift the flour. They all said, we're busy. Help me knead the dough. They were busy. Finally, she bakes the bread and she puts it out on the windowsill. And all the animals smell the bread. And they all come marching in. And she says, what you guys doing? And they said, we have time now. We could help you eat. And the chicken says, no, if you didn't have time to help me plant and take out the weeds and harvest and thresh and sift the flour and knead, so now when it comes time to eat, then you don't have time to eat. And we see this in our parasha. This concept really, Shlomo HaMelech said, Notzer Teina, one who watches over the fig, Yochal Piriya, will eat the fruit. If you invest and you watch over something, then you'll eat the fruits in the end. People are always willing to eat. And when you want to eat, everyone wants to join you. The Gemara says, if you own a makolet, everyone wants to be your friend. Figure they'll get a good deal on this, they'll get a good deal on that. When your business goes bankrupt, then no one knows you. The Gemara says this. So, notzel teina, if someone watches the fig tree and takes care of it, yochal piriya, I'll eat the fruits in it. Yoshua spent his whole life watching over the Torah, seeing to it that he learns properly, that the Beis Medrash function properly. So at the end of the days, when Moshe's time to pass came, Yoshua was already an old man. Nonetheless, he got the leadership. There were other people who were willing to take the leadership, but they hadn't watched it like Yoshua did. Yoshua takes the leadership. Moshe takes him in front of everyone, and he places both hands on him. God told him to place one hand, and Moshe does it with a full heart. He has an ayin tova, he has a good eye. You remember in last week's parsha, we said one of the traits of Bilam is he has a bad eye. He looks badly upon things. When other people have things, he's jealous. He wants more for himself. He can't stand giving, and he always wants to take. Moshe is the exact opposite. He always wants to give. Rav Dessler develops the philosophy that there are two functions in this world, and a person could be of two groups in this world. There are those who like to give and those who like to take. A person can be a giver or a person can be a taker. There are two types of actions in this world. You're either giving or taking, one or the other. And when a person is being good, then he's giving. And when a person is loving, he's giving. And when a person is being bad, he's taking. That's Rav Dessler develops it a long way in his sefer, but this is a very deep thought about how you could break down almost every action you do. And whether you're loving someone else or loving yourself in a relationship, are you giving or taking? So Moshe Rabbeinu has a good eye. He always wants to give. And Rav Dessler develops it even further, that a person who likes to give does not like to take. He wants to give. There are others that develop it that I think that's what, I haven't seen Rav Dessler in a few years. I think he even extends it that far. And there are others, in the Dati Lumi crowd, there's a strong philosophy that says that if you know how to give truthfully, then you'll also know how to accept truthfully. There's room for whatever you want to say. Huh?
Does Rav Dessler say that that's more of a virtue not to take, or...
I don't know. I don't remember enough. It's been a few years since I said it. I don't remember it clearly.
Sometimes I get in trouble. People will get offended if I
accept
something.
Yeah. There's a Gemara. The Gemara says that in order to get engaged for Kedushin to occur, the woman has to get something from the man. The Gemara says there's an instance where the man is prime minister, he's president, he has an important position, he's an Adam Chashuv, and the woman wants to give him a gift. So his acceptance of the gift is like he gave her a gift, and the Gemara says he could be mekadesher, that's worth money, and he could actually get engaged to her. Instead of giving her a ring, he could say, by the value of my accepting your gift, you become engaged to me. That's a halacha. That an Adam Chashuv, a person who's of high stature, can give her, what he's giving her is the pleasure of his accepting her gift. When they were signing the treaty, there was some kind of treaty between the United States and Russia. I don't remember which treaty it was. There was a reporter there, who ran up to President, I think it was Bush or Clinton at the time, and he gave him a pen and he said, please use my pen. And he said, okay. He took that pen and he signed it. That reporter became a millionaire because he was able to sell the pen for I don't know how much in an auction later. It was a pen that a big treaty was signed between the United States and Russia, a smart reporter. But there's also the concept that President Bush accepted my pen. So, yeah, accepting something is also sometimes you're giving someone something. I always feel that if you help someone a lot, then you have to accept readily from that person. Because otherwise you make the person feel like he's always a taker. And if you want to give him some honor, then you allow him to feel like he's also a giver. And sometimes you feel like, I don't need this. Yeah, that's not the point. You're going to make him feel like a better person. He'll feel more honorable. That's why it's better if you get a person a job than if you get him stuck on. A person doesn't want to feel like he's accepting. That's one of the worst feelings a person can have. So the person has to think of a smart way of doing it. That's why sometimes we give people good deals instead of giving it for free. Figure out how to help the person afford it, so to speak. We see here that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't jealous of his Talmud. The Gemara says a person is jealous of everyone but his Talmud and his son. And this is an important point on two fronts. A, you shouldn't be jealous of your Talmidim. You shouldn't be jealous of your children. Parents sometimes say, if this kashrus is good enough for me, why does he need to do better? What do you mean, why does he need to do better? You should want your kids to do better. That's ridiculous. If he's doing better, let him do better. You should want him to do better. A normal parent wants his kid to do better. My father brought us up. He always used to say, I'm your minimum. I'm not your maximum. You can't do less than me. You must do at least what I'm doing and hopefully more. And I think that's a healthy attitude as a parent. You have to try and push your kids forward, huh?
So you ask your father to buy a glad kosher, whatever, more lemonade, even if he doesn't have
the money for it. Oh, so that's a practical question. How do you do it? I'm talking about the attitude of the parent. The attitude of the parent has to be, I want my kid to move forward. But this also teaches us something on the other front, and that is that the beginning of the verse was, everyone is jealous of everyone else but their own son and their own disciple.
Yeah,
remember that. Anything you do, if you're walking around with too big a smile on your face, people are jealous of you. If your wife is too good looking, people are jealous of you. If you're wearing clothing that are too fancy, people are jealous of you. And they'll stick a knife in your back whenever they could. It's the nature of people. The Ramchal says that there's no person that doesn't get stung when he's at someone else's wedding. Everyone feels a little pang of pain. So everyone has to be aware of that. We say on the one hand we should develop Ein Tova. On the other hand, we have to be aware that chances are we haven't done it yet. And for sure no one around us has done it. The Gemara says that if a person feels like he has an Ein Ra, he's looking badly at someone else, what should he do? So the Gemara gives a segula. I don't know why it works, but the Gemara says he should look at his left nostril. He should look down with his eye at the left side of his nose. Why does that work? I don't know. That's what it says in the Gemara.
There's a difference between being jealous of everyone else and assuming and trying not to be walk with too much pride and having people be jealous of you. It's two different things.
If you're assuming that everyone's going to be jealous of you, and we assume that when people are jealous of a person, then that can harm him, so then we should try to minimize their jealousy. We have to try and minimize the areas where they will be able to be jealous of us. The Gemara says that when Hannah prayed for a son, so she said, "V'natatali zera anashim." She asked Hashem, give me a child who is among men. So the Gemara has many understandings what that means. One of the understandings, the Gemara says, he shouldn't be too tall, he shouldn't be too short, he shouldn't be too smart, he shouldn't be too dumb. So Rashi says, why shouldn't he be too smart? Rashi says, if he's too smart, then everyone will be talking about him. That's not good for him. He shouldn't be something that people look and say, oh, it's so good for him. I always tell couples when they're dating that if it's going good, they shouldn't tell anyone. It's funny, I told this to a couple who were not so, you're not talking about like such religious people. And the guy told me, yeah, every time it's going good and people see it, suddenly it goes bad. We feel like people are giving us an ayin hara. And we don't believe in ayin hara. He told me, I don't believe in it. But every time, that's what happens. So people have to be careful. In everything they do, you don't want other people to see what you're doing and be jealous. There's nothing more beautiful than tzniut. The Gemara says that the first luchos were destroyed and the luchos were God-made because they came down with big fanfare. So you ask yourself, who was jealous? I don't know. Maybe the nations of the world. I don't know who was jealous. Bottom line, they came down with fanfare and the whole world heard it and the whole world shook and they were destroyed. Now, instead of continuing the parsha, if you guys have strength, I'd like to take a few minutes to discuss Shivas or Betamuz and the aspects of the destruction.
Can you say real quick, what luchos is?
Luchos are the tablets.
Okay.
Okay.